Gentlemen, this is a bill that deals with conflicts of interest between employees of political subdivisions or political bodies. Basically, what it does is increase the population limit from 5,000 to 10,000, and the amounts involved, which are accepted from the public interest or from the conflict provision, to $1,000 from $500. And then you have subsection 2, which, as I understand it, was inserted by the Committee on Local Government, which would further accept persons from complying with the conflict of interest provision of subsection 1 if they made full disclosure of any economic interest under the laws related to the Government Ethics Commission.
Madam Chairman. I move that we delete the new subsection 2, lines 18 to 21. The reason is I don't think that mere compliance with this should open up the field to any public official doing business with the body which he's a member of. If this were left in here, the mayor of Portland set up a contracting business and do business with the city of Portland as long as he disclosed that he was in the contracting business. Not that he's going to, he doesn't have to be a contractor, but it could happen. It just really opened the thing up. And I don't think the ethics thing is good enough to govern against this. On the other hand, I suspect this 5,000 has been in there quite a while. I don't think it would hurt anything if it raised 10, so I'd be willing to support the bill if we take out sub 2.
To the motion, I'm going to support it reluctantly. I think that I think it's a good subsection, and I'm on most of them committee, and I think it's wise to do that. Not the same fact that the mayor of Portland could go into contracting business. I think that the people of Portland would either permit it, and once they knew about it, would either continue him in office and assume that's all right, or retire to a full-time contracting position. But I think that the vulnerability is that the ethics commission is so new and we're so uncertain about how this is going to operate that I think Burns got a point, and I think that point would prevail on the floor, and the bill's too important to lose it because of that paragraph. So I'm going to support this. It may come back, maybe bring it back to 77. If we can make the disclosures and work well, then I think ultimately this is going to be the answer to that rather than the other stuff. But I think it's that point.
Thank you. It's been on the next
one. It was put on the next one.
Aye. Move it out due fast as amended.
Madam Chairman, I might mention that Bob Ward, who has some position with the School of Architecture at the University of Oregon, called and indicated that the chancellor evidently is interpreting this particular provision as prohibiting, person who is working as a part-time instructor. For instance, there's an architect in the community that is teaches one or two classes on his own specialty, and according to Mr. Ward, this does preclude them from hiring people who are experts in particular areas, and he would like to see some amendments to this section which would allow them to do that.
How would this do?
Well, it works against it in the sense that, say, if an architect is a member of a firm which enters into a contract with the university to design future facilities, or if the architect himself were to do something like that while he was teaching part time.
To the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation of due pass.
Other than the defendant, except under certain circumstances. Major differences then are how the procedure is determined to determine when inquiry should be made and under what circumstances. You'll notice that Senate Bill 429 says that this procedure can be at or before trial. It is our conclusion that probably the better procedure would be to have it at trial, but before testimony was offered. Now, you'll also notice that there's a difference in language in subsection 4. That is, in line 18, you'll see that Senate Bill 429 says that the defendant wishes to offer evidence. You'll notice that House Bill 2241 says if the defendant wishes to elicit evidence or testimony. Now, the purpose for that broader language is that you could have an insinuating question asked, which would not technically be evidence under the law and the rules of evidence, and that would be designed and created to send this quiet in the mind of the jury, as would legally introduced evidence. We felt that broadening the language there would accomplish the purposes of the bill without creating any different problems. In that respect, I do submit that the line 2241 there is superior to that of 429, which references the time problem the legislation is attempting to address. Then, since the decision of 2241 was to make the in-camera hearing at trial, we felt that the notion of presenting a written motion supported by an affidavit would be both too restrictive and would be unnecessarily time-consuming, since a speaking motion to be made and is commonly made of criminal trial with respect to all kinds of matters. So we felt that simply providing for taking testimony or whatever evidence is necessary in mind of the judge to establish it would be superior to requiring a written motion. And again, that's based upon the policy decision made by your other house that an at trial hearing would be preferable to fewer problems than a pre-trial hearing.
I understand the women wanted a pre-trial hearing.
Well, that's, there was some argument that the pre-trial hearing should be held because then the issue could be appealed. That, however, is not the legal advice we have received from the Office of Solicitor General. So under no circumstances allow evidence to be appealable or ongoing a motion to suppress evidence to be appealable. So that actually the policy objective of the notion of a pre-trial hearing could not be accomplished in any event. That was persuasive to me that it would be an empty letter. But obviously there's some discussion as to whether or not there would be another reason for having that. The other question that bothered some members of the committee, as well as Professor Strong, was whether or not a pre-trial hearing might raise some of the problems that were created in the Warrior case that led to the Supreme Court overturning of the Oregon alibi test. I'm not really confident to deal with that question. And again, Mr. Joyce is the first party that the Supreme Court has completely. One final point, Madam Chairman, that is the question of standards that are to be applied during the in-camera hearing. And that's a major, but perhaps not a major, but it is a policy and language difference between 2241 and 429. In 429, the defendant has to offer, by clear and convincing evidence, a given standard. With Professor Strong's conclusion that that clear and convincing evidence standard is simply inapplicable to a balancing test, that basically, conceptually, analytically, it doesn't fit. I only offer you, again, his memorandum on that point, which I believe the chairman and some members of the committee have. The second point, and really more important one, is the language that you'll find on page 3 of Senate Bill 429. And that requires a balancing test. To be engaged in by the judge to determine whether the probative value of the complainant's previous sexual conduct outweighs the prejudice or social harm in him. That's a balancing test which Mr. Joyce argued before our committee might create constitutional problems for the trial judge to improperly cast the balance and articulate his reasons for doing so. House Bill 2241 simply states that if the judge determines it's relevant, not otherwise inadmissible, the judge can go into an order and control the nature and manner of the discussion of the evidence, but it makes no attempt to articulate a balancing test that may oppose those problems. I don't believe it would be proper for me to go any more into the deliberations of our own committee and dissenting or agreement on the constitutional merits of that proposition. But I only point out to you that because of that, 2241 is yet missing on our list, including the balancing test.
We have amendments. Yes, to the 429, do you have amendments to the House bill?
No, we don't have amendments. Although, the only amendment that we have, which is representative past request, which would apply to both bills, is to put an emergency clause on whichever the county is passing the court favorably.
Very quickly, I want to point out that one other advantage of House Bill 2241 is slightly broader coverage. It covers sexual abuse and abuse of and rape. And we thought that was a worthwhile addition. Representative Cronemeyer has very well summarized the rest of a very long debate in House issue. I wanted to point out that the use of the word or testimony at line 16 the A.M. Gross House Bill 2241 is intended to deal with the question of whether or not impeachment is covered. I think you suggested there's another reason, but evidence as opposed to testimony. Impeachment is not evidence, of course, at least that's what the jury told me, but it is testimony. So we wanted to be darned to declare that we're not going to permit impeachment by the use of this particular material, even though that was the substance of the bill, the way we had it read before. So that's why that's there. Any kind of balancing test, in my judgment, which supports to offset the relevance of evidence against the potential damage to reputation of the witness, probably will not withstand constitutional scrutiny where these questions are still the answer to the accused. That's why I asked the committee to take out and the committee decided to take out. I think the clear and convincing evidence standard is the standard that applies to fact finding and not to a balancing test. But it's simply conceptually or analytically inappropriate to apply a clear and convincing test to a balancing test.
Then what is Mike talking about?
Mike is talking.
My concern is this. It's based most recently on the MMA transportation of the Oregon Supreme Court, but there are a lot of others. I think the Oregon courts, both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, are going to rule that the rule of law which prohibits the jury from hearing evidence which is palpably relevant, and which has been ruled out for other reasons, is probably going to take the statute that still limits such evidence unconstitutional. Concerned about that based upon Warrior, more based upon MMA Smith, which may remember the one where they just ruled that the gal who had evidence introduced in her trial that she committed the same crime in the same way against the victim on a previous occasion and was then denied the right to show she'd been acquitted of those previous charges had been denied due process. It's the same kind of problem arises here. You can't exclude for any reason other than the relevance of evidence which tends to be acquittal of the defendant.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to move that we report out House Bill 2241 recast.
You want the motion?
No, I don't think so. I don't know any reason it is.
Say what you want from the Central Court not in the what portion of the Senate building I think of Section 4 are the in the
My view, the House bill actually took Senate Bill 429 and inserted it into 2241, and then chipped away at and made some changes in Section 4. My own view, maybe my own view, I was less certain of the constitutional objection to the balancing test than was the Solicitor General, but I'll admit that I'm not required to defend this statute before an appellate court. I think that other parts of Section 4 are better than 429. For example, the evidence or testimony business, clarifying that it shall be at trial, broadening the circumstances under which the motion can be made. The basic difference is that whether you want to use a clear and convincing evidence standard, which is really unanimous or convinced, which I think is unworkable analytically, and whether or not that's balancing.
Amendments were allowed to 429. Then there will be the differences between 429 and 2241.
Well, first of all, you would still have a pre-trial hearing. With Herb Titus's amendments, as the Senate bill is now drafted, it makes an alternative. You can either have pre-trial or during trial hearing as to whether or not this evidence is going to be admitted. Titus's amendments would require hearing before trial. It also would be in camera. He also would put up in subsection 2 expressly that evidence of prior sexual conduct with persons other than the defendant are inadmissible. This would simply be putting into the statute the existing case law. He expands upon the contents of a court's order if the court either decides to admit or not to admit evidence of prior sexual conduct with the defendant. Simply more detailed language as to what the court must do. He would also require that after this hearing is conducted, the state is required to disclose any rebuttal evidence that it intends to put forward with regard to the evidence that the defendant brings out in the hearing that he's going to use to undercut the reputation, not necessarily the reputation, but go to the issue of consent. Herb Titus's amendments also would prohibit the use of any evidence that comes out in the pretrial hearing in any other criminal proceeding unless that other criminal proceeding were a proceeding against the defendant for perjury or false swearing in the hearing.
And
I'm going to ask you a question. Let's put your judgment on the question. Well, the House Committee, I think it's fair to say, decided on doing it at trial because I conceded that I didn't gain anything out of the pre-trial. The original fact that maybe I could appeal and have this ruling, or at least that was the thought. But the fact is, I can't. A ruling which admits evidence is not an appealable ruling, only one that excludes it. For the rest of it, it just seems to me to complicate what's now already come into a fairly extended omnibus hearing prior to trial. You can either do it or not as you please. Herb Titus's amendment will point to the problem that definitely will arise, and that's the wordiest related problem. Once one side gets disclosed with one piece of information, there's an offsetting duty, the other side to disclose what they're going to do about it. So on, you get into a kind of endless round of discussions in that regard. Now that's, from a prosecution's point of view, that's both good and bad. It's kind of nice to know what they're going to claim ahead of time, so you can plan on evidence for the contrary. But then that means you have to make that disclosure and put together to delay the entire process. I'm not troubled by the matter of the trial, even though I argue the other way.
Yeah, it seems to me that the way the House bill is drafted responds to the concerns that I had or raised at the time of hearing, and I really think that they did a good job in bringing about a fair and balanced piece of legislation. I just don't see anything wrong with it, and here it is now. I've made the motion. If someone else thinks the emergency clause ought to be attached, I don't feel strongly about that one way or another. I just move to send it out due past the way it is. You know, someone else should add the emergency clause.
I think it's
the possibilities of abuse are greater with unsalaried officials than they are with salaried officials. And I haven't recently seen it, but I've known of instances where there can be a lot of corruption in these unsalaried people. And that's where the real hanky panky is.
$1,000.
Huh? Well, what our figure, what we raised it to $1,000, it's over that, but I don't think that, I just don't think it's good practice to allow people to do business for themselves. These little fiddling things, but if they want to be a contractor and do business with the city, well, let them be a contractor, but not hold office. Too easy to justify your conduct. They probably don't intend to do anything wrong. They figure they've got the best thing there. It's going to be hard for those other councilmen to do things. I don't know. The figure, we raised the 500 or 1,000, remember?
We got it.
They have to be like Cleopatra's wife, or what it would. Caesar's wife. Cleopatra's wife. We're going to start, I guess, the ERA now. We're going to start talking about Cleopatra's wife.
Yes, Madam Chairman.
First Amendment is put forward by the Children's Service Division, and it would be to page 2, line 27.
Are they in the classroom?
No, they're not. This is just a couple words here. Evidently, as the bill was originally drafted, you look at line 27, it refers to intentional means. Originally, the bill read by means other than accidental, and Children's Services Division, I believe, would propose that you delete intentional and put in other than accidental means.
What would be the difference?
I'm not sure. I suppose that other than accidental may be a broader say, but I don't think I really can't say that there's going to be that much of a difference either way. Perhaps Joe Kim can indicate that he has.
I think we need
child abuse is not intentional?
Well, in the sense that the person is emotionally unstable, and then the individual will be unstable. Our point here is that it should not be the responsibility of the reporter to make a judgment as to whether that abuse is intentional or not intentional. That's the judicial
decision.
Well, I'm not sure if I understand. You're talking about intentional being in the sense that they had the intent to injure as distinguished from the doing of an intentional act. Now, how is the, let's see the present language. A physical is caused by intentional means. And so if I get mad at my kids and I really worked up and I just start slapping him, I think I'd be covered, even though I didn't intend that he should cause a permanent injury. So that's intentional means. And so I don't think the amendment just fogs the issue, it seemed to me. It just says the same thing in a different way. This doesn't say that the injury is intentionally caused. I mean, it doesn't say that they intended to injure. It just says, a physical injury to a child caused by intentional means.
Madam Chairman, you might get asked this concern by simply saying any physical injury to a child would appear to have been caused by intentional means. If that's a concern, say that if somebody sees a child that's injured, I guess the Children's Services Division is afraid that they will think that they have to have very clear evidence that something was intentional. I suppose you could put the language in simply that it appears to have been caused by intentional means, and that would.
Now, what does this section What does this section refer to? Is this just a reporting provision?
Yes.
It doesn't have nothing to do with the establishment of fault.
Well, no, it has nothing to do. There are no criminal sanctions attached to. You don't prosecute somebody for child abuse. The Oregon Nurses Association proposes that on page 3, line 9, where they have license to registered nurse, they propose that the licensed practical nurse and life is registered there. Again, this amendment came in at the last yesterday, and I don't know the difference between a registered nurse or a practical nurse, but
the ONA suggested.
Yes.
I move the amendment. If anyone would object to practical nurses, they would, and if they're for it, I would say.
Yes, there are a few. On page 4, line 9, just my suggestion here, they've indicated any other person may report in such manner. I really don't think that language adds anything. Clearly, anybody can report in any manner that they want to child abuse. And if you require, if you say any person may report in any such manner, it may be interpreted as limiting the way in which any other person might report child abuse, saying that they can only report it in the manner that's required under this chapter.
I move to delete the new language on 8 and 9.
No, I don't. That's really an immunity provision relating only to those people required. Well, no, it would relate to anybody who reports. Except that I don't think it takes care of this particular language here. You're really talking about, say, when you say any such manner, you're talking about the specific manner required by this statute, and I don't think that that's really what is intended. If you look at page 6, lines 2-5, currently the statute requires Children's Services Division to make records of child abuse available to physicians who request them. If that is what is intended, which I think it is, I think the change that you see in lines 2-5 on page 6 is not intended to change the existing law. I think that the lines do change the existing law because it deletes the provision saying that the Children's Services Division is authorized to close reports to physicians. It simply says the physician may request it, but there's no language now which says that the Children's Services Division is authorized to disclose these reports to physicians. And my suggestion would simply be to delete the new language there and retain the old language. The only other suggested amendments I would make, and they're just a matter of housekeeping, is in the penalty provision, section 12 on page 6, beginning in line 24. If the committee wishes, you could go through those penalties and classify them at this time. It's nothing that that important, but you might clean up the statutes if you want to.
Is this, you mean to confirm them with the general criminal code that
yeah.
we adopted before? Well, Madam Chairman, I move that we, I don't know how you can do it, have John prepare mm-hmm. amendments.
If you look at line 25, subsection 1 there, it's really almost comparable to the penalties that are attached to a Class A misdemeanor. Class A misdemeanor is a year in jail and or a $1,000 fine. The only difference is that this provides a maximum limit of $500 fine. So my suggestion would be to simply go to a Class A misdemeanor there.
Not so much. How about two? You want to do something?
Two is unclassified misdemeanor, which means it has the same penalties that are associated with the Class A misdemeanor. So you may as well make that a Class A misdemeanor.
That's so neat. Mm-hmm.
Three is simply a violation, and it would just be stating that it is a violation punishable by a fine not exceeding $100.
There's nothing wrong with it, anyway.
What is the word?
You could change the wording to make it consistent with the penalty provisions of the more recent criminal code.
I so much.
Sub four is the same penalty that attaches to a Class B misdemeanor under the existing statute.
I move that.
Five is unclassified misdemeanor, which would be a Class A misdemeanor.
Same motion.
And the only other thing would be in seven to conform that language to indicate that it is a violation.
I make that motion too. What about six? What are you doing with that?
That already is in the same language as the more recent criminal penalty.
Yes.
So.
Hey Robert, have you Senate Bill 65 and 4 as amended? Did you pass recommendations for discussion?
I have some suggested amendments, Madam Chairman. On page 2, line 23, I think it would be clear if you simply said, unless it is duly incorporated under the laws of any state, rather than just leave it hanging, unless it is duly incorporated.
So moved.
Objection, discussion, adoption.
I wonder if there's something in here about legislative support. How do we have that? I don't really like to have statutes requiring reports to the legislature. Why is that in here on page 4?
Is that in here?
Yeah,
on page 4. Mm-hmm. 112.
Of course, there's already one in
here. Yeah.
It's already
in
here.
Already in the law. They just put it in the interim.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's nothing wrong with it if you follow it. It's already in. It's just
the interim. Yeah.
Yeah, that's all right.
Are you doing that?
No, that is covered.
Well, I guess so. I'll move it out to speak fast.
Can you put the news on reimbursement of 72 and 80 in the
If by some remote chance I were assigned that last bill, I'd like the Children's Services Division to give me a memorandum. Yeah, I'm just the kind of bill. I just sensed that she was going to assign that doggone thing to me, so maybe not. Well, set it yourself. Yeah.
No, I was just waiting for you.
Betty and I will not file a complaint right away, please.
Well, not today. We're having a meeting.
Someone in the audience may have it.
I would definitely be there. We're helping our allies.
Madam Chairman, this particular bill sets up an alternative means by which Public Welfare Division can collect payments improperly made or overpayments which were made incorrectly. The alternative means of collecting them would be an administrative hearing, and it provides that the defendant in such a hearing has the option of requiring the division to go to court. We did have that particular bill in committee, and I think it was tabled. It's not the same type. It does make changes to the same section that we were considering before, but not the same type of changes. So it sets up this alternative procedure, and if, say, there is a final determination made in this administrative procedure, it provides that the Welfare Division can get a warrant to direct the sheriff to execute on the property of the recipient who has received improper payments or overpayments.
Let me ask you a question. If there is currently a vendor and is doing this for the Welfare Division and they're getting overpayment, I think they'd be a vendor in the future. Why can't they negotiate this overpayment?
They can. And I would imagine that would take place prior to any administrative hearing proceeding or a court action. It would be a matter of the division approaching the vendor and indicating that they think there is an overpayment, and if their books indicate that, I would think that a motion procedure would be worked out short of going to a hearing.
Are these improper payments because of fraud on the vendor's part, or improper payments because of mistakes for the public welfare division?
Could be both.
Why is the law necessary? They can recover that now.
They can recover, but only through court action. And they want to have the option of using an administrative procedure or administrative hearing to do this as well.
Because they want to enter the court.
It would say if it, the difference is this, if they were going to go to court, they would have to take it, I believe, to the circuit court. Whereas if you had a hearing, the appeal would be to the Court of Appeals. directly, it would not be for the court.
What is the,
In other words, they could do it all themselves rather than going to the court.
That's right. Although they do provide that if they initiate an administrative hearing, the defendant still has the right to take it back to court or force them to go through the court procedure.
And
they have to notify the recipient of that what is ongoing.
Is there anyone here that could tell us why they think that the extraordinary remedy is necessary in this case?
I'm Lee Nelson, and with the Ministry of Service and Veterans of the Public Welfare Division. The first thing that occurs, and the reason it's first thing to be in there is that from the standpoint, there's three parts to this. There's the vendors, both medical and the providers of other services, and the recipients themselves are the three parts. Now, in the matter of the recipients, they are and have been have the administrative procedure. And when we get to the end of the administrative hearing and have a decision, if there's an amount due, we do not have money judgment. And we have to go back to court and sue all over again, get a money judgment from court. Recovery, and it's particularly true if I can resolve public assistance to back restored to you know, take care of themselves and without going back to court in regards to the recipient, we don't have a money judgment. So the procedure that we propose there for more follows through following the administrative means to enforce the recovery.
Now, is that someone that's on welfare yet, or someone who's off and you're going after him later?
Well, if you give us a procedure, we can go, if he's off, we can go administrative hearing instead of going to either the small things court, the district court, or the circuit court, depending on the amount involved. We can go to the administrative procedure, ask and have an administrative hearing, and go that route. That's what that's the added method doing the recovery to all the things.
I feel that administrative hearing would be held first.
Will be held in the county where the person is
held in the county.
Yes, in the county where he is. We do that now. We hold those in the county where the person resides. And of course, he desires counsel, he has counsel, and all the rest of it. Sections that are involved in chapter 183. Then, in regards to vendors and providers, we get into situations where people, for some reason or another, are at odds with us over fees or matters that. Relates to what we understand to be what we're paying for and what they actually deliver in the way of service, and we do try to work these out on an individual basis, but of course people don't always agree. And at the present time, under the statute, there's a serious question as to how effective our means are in regard to the language and existing statutes under the question of needy and some of the other language, and that was cleared up, I believe, in sections 10 and 11, and more specifically addressed itself now to the amount paid and the basis for that. In regard to the administrative hearing, actually, this came out of legislative question at the hearing before the Senate Human Resources Committee, where it was suggested by one of their members that
we include the administrative hearing as part of the procedure so that the people who are involved in a question of overpayment, they all went to the same remedy as opposed to having the providers, both medical and other service providers, have the resources of the court, but the person on public assistance would have the administrative hearing process. So at that time, it was suggested by one of the members of the committee that that would be included in that amendment. We did not originally ask for it. We have no problem with it. We do it just as we do anything else. We would start with an administrative procedure and notification and so forth, and if the person did not object to it and want to go to the court or proper jurisdiction in regard to not involved, we would go through the administrative procedure and at the end of the administrative procedure and have a hearing in court.
Now, this bill then would say that a person in all cases could either have the administrative procedure, but if you requested it, you could have it heard before.
Yes, depending on the amount of money involved, you go to small claims, go to district court, and you go on to circuit court.
Well, no. I have limited knowledge of the negotiation that goes on between vendors and the welfare division. And at this point, I think it's a legitimate balance because if it's aggravated, the welfare division is pulling into court. If it's not aggravated, they're going to negotiate with it. But if you allow this amendment to an administrative hearing, I think you give the cause of trouble to the welfare division. I'm believing they ought to do that. You may answer that question. But the point is that while we're still running at some cases 50%, some cases 80% of vendors at cost, I don't want to have the welfare division with another club hand to the administrative division.
I would only comment, Senator, that certainly the individual that we're dealing with, whether it be a medical vendor or a service vendor, if he had his concerns regarding the administrative procedure, all he has to do is ask that it be transferred to court to the jurisdiction he wants to get through, so he has that.
That's my point, but a $20 item, you can't transfer to any court. And the point is, the administrative hearing may or may not be loaded, and you can't go to court for a $20 or $25 or $100 item.
Well, is there anything in the bill that says you can't?
No, I just don't think it's worthwhile to do it, is my point. And I don't think it will be done. I think they'll
initiate an administrative hearing for that small amount either. They wouldn't initiate an administrative hearing for that small amount either.
No, but they would.
Well, would even they? I mean, it costs them $15 to process the thing.
It doesn't cost judges anything.
Well, I don't think that's accurate. And I think most agency people recognize that, you know, they recognize the cost. Just the other day somewhere, I can't remember, someone was talking about how it cost $15 to make a demand. Oh, it was in the Revenue Committee. They wanted to do away with fees for certain publications. The reason being, even though you charge $2, it would cost $15 to collect $2. So I think most agencies.
The point is that many of these questions are judgment questions. And I think that they're subject to negotiation between the vendor and the welfare. So, you're in the area of negotiation.
Well, I think it's a question of how needed this is.
Wouldn't it be wrong to continue whatever negotiating goes on prior to the meeting?
Absolutely. If were attempting to establish is to take care of those that were not successful in negotiating with in regard to the
recovery from a vendor wherever, say, the vendor has received payments from public assistance or from public welfare and then receives additional payments for the same services from the recipient or some other source. Speaking to ORS 411-690, which is amended in Section 10. Yeah, that's what that particular section currently does. If you look on page 6, down on line 13 through 15, that subsection that is being deleted allows them to prosecute civil actions to recover these monies. In addition to deleting that, the bill would allow the Public Welfare Division to also recover in instances where they've paid a vendor more money than what the services really were worth. Okay, now, with that in mind, if you go back to page 2 on line 25, it seems that the change there on line 25 is really to make sure that you still assure the public Welfare Division the right to sue or the right to hold its administrative hearing. The problem that I see with it is that it refers only to those instances where there's an excessive amount provided. And I think that language can fairly easily be interpreted to say that the Public Welfare Division can only bring a civil action or conduct an administrative hearing in instances where they provided more to the vendor than actually was served
service to the recipient, and not in instances where the vendor has received a double payment from the recipient or some other person. So I would suggest that the First Amendment be on page 2, line 25, to simply delete that, or in an excessive amount as provided. So if you have a general reference to ORS 411690, otherwise I think you're going to take away from public welfare rights which they now have to recover funds paid.
That would be
By what?
All that.
Can you validate the amendment? Is there an objection?
The next amendment would be on line 32 of page 2. This comes from the Public Welfare Division. And they would propose that after the word recipient, on line 32, to be inserted the following language, or the guardian or conservator of the recipient, so that they could recover not only from the estate, but also from the guardian or conservator of the recipient.
Okay.
Over on page 3, line 20, in the new section 4 there, they refer to recovery from the recipient or a vendor of services, and then refer to 411-690 and 414-105. Those two sections relate only to vendors, as they've been amended, and not to recipients at all. I think that the intent here is to have it apply also to 411-620, where there is recovery from a recipient. So I would propose that after ORS, you insert 411-620 on line 20. Finally, something that you might consider, if you go back to page 6, lines 17 through 19, that language, as I interpret it, currently allows the Public Welfare Division to recover improper payments of medical assistance from the recipient, or say a vendor. That's the way I read that. If you delete that language and insert the language that's proposed, it allows recovery only from a vendor, and there's no provision authorizing recovery from a recipient. I don't know whether that's the intent or not, but if you want to make it clear that the division may recover from a recipient as well as a vendor, I would suggest that you retain that language just deleted in a form, may recover from a recipient, just changing it a bit and making the language that starts any person as defined in 174-100 except a subsection.
So what you're saying, you should keep the deleted language and then add the new language?
Yes, that if you want to make the decision to allow the Public Welfare Division to recover from a recipient as well as a vendor, I think that you need some additional language there, and I think that the language that's deleted accomplishes that. As amended, 414-105 now applies only to recovery from a vendor, except where you're talking about somebody who's a recipient and over 65 years of age.
Again, two bills. One was provided for coverage against the provider, and one against the welfare recipient, and submitted them into one single bill that would provide equal procedures and remedies. So that was just an oversight.
I move Senate Bill 240 to the floor.
Go ahead, John. I don't think there are any proposed amendments.
I have only one proposed amendment to it, and that's on page 2, line 12. I think we should insert reasonable attorney fees rather than simply attorney fees.
I would go move. Well, let me tell you, correct me, John, if I'm wrong. Maybe you can go ahead and tell me. It basically is a bill that has been a practice for many years, particularly with collection agencies, where a contract is assigned to them. The purchaser of the whatever it is has or believes he has a claim against the seller. But under the current law, all that a buyer can do is assert his claim against the seller as a counterclaim, but he can't affirmatively collect from the seller if there were a breach of contract there. And so, consequently, he ends up, would have to defend the one lawsuit against the collection agency, and then he'd have to turn around if he had a claim against the seller and bring an affirmative action against the seller to recover. What this would do is to say that anybody who sued on one of these, basically on a purchase contract of some kind, can bring in the original seller and make him a party, and then try the whole controversy at that time. It's all it really involves. And I think it's just fair. And it's a peculiarity of the law, of our law of assignment, that prevents that from being done now.
Any questions or discussion on the motion? That's fine, right?
Have in your packet a compilation of the existing class action laws for statutes in Oregon. This particular class action statute was enacted by the legislature at the last regular session. The proposed changes to Senate Bill 271 would make are these. First of all, it would repeal the provisions in the class action law which require a pre-litigation notice to potential defendant. In other words, now before 30 days before, say, somebody who's going to bring a class action where there are common questions of law or fact, they have to notify the defendant, and the defendant has an opportunity to make good any wrong that he has committed that gives the class a right to recover. That particular, or those particular sections and that entire mechanism would be repealed by this particular bill. When you're dealing with a class action that is brought on the basis of common questions of law or fact, the existing law provides various things that the judge must consider in determining whether or not he's going to certify a class. And those are listed on page 3, generally in lines 4 through 23. With the exception of subparagraph C and F, in this particular provision, the provision is very similar to the Federal Act, Federal Rule 23. This bill would delete the legislative directions that a judge shall make or shall consider various things in determining whether or not he's going to certify a class under the provision relating to common questions of law or fact. Right now, if a judge does determine that there are common questions of law or fact, he has to make specific findings as to what those facts are and must state separately his conclusion with regard to that. This bill would delete that requirement. The bill would also delete provisions relating to when a class action may be dismissed without notice to members of the class. Currently, if it's going to be dismissed and there's no prejudice to the other members of the class and the court assures that there's been no payment made between the defendant and the class representatives or their attorney, the class action can be dismissed without notice to all of the members of the class. This bill would delete that particular provision in the statute now. Probably the most controversial portion of this bill begins on page 4, line 28, and extends over to page 5 through line 27. Now, if has been a determination of liability, the court is required to require each member of the class to file a claim form. If they don't file this claim form, their rights with regard to bringing any class action in the future are dismissed. They can't, they're not going to recover in this particular action, and they're not going to have a right to bring a class action themselves in the future. This bill would propose that that particular claim form need not be filed or required to be filed by the court. The court could, in its discretion, determine whether or not he thought it was necessary. So long as you could reasonably identify a majority of the class, then this claim form, according to the proposals in this bill, shall not be required. Another significant change that it would make would be that it would allow the court to, in its discretion, determine whether or not any notice required under the class action statute should be paid by the defendant, the plaintiff, or a combination of two. And then it would also allow for what is called fluid recovery, which basically is where you're not able to identify all or some of the members of the class, but you can determine that certain damages could be awarded if those members could be identified. Then it would allow the court to award those damages and kind of tailor the remedies to whatever the court thought was
equitable in the situation. Where it says if they couldn't find certain members or identify certain members of the class, the court might direct that those damages go to some organization that supports the interest, that the court might determine are those interests of the class, that members of the class that can't identify. It would also require that if liability is found and damages can be ascertained, that those damages not be retained with the defendant in instances where you can't identify some members of the class. Currently, that could be done, and this says definitely that the defendant has to pay the damages, and the court is to figure out how it's going to handle them.
And so, John, we could provide an assured recovery that anything left would just speak. That would seem reasonable to me.
You could make more specific provisions as to how the legislature wants the thing to be handled and not leave it in the discretion of the judge. The bill also makes attorney fees mandatory where the class prevails, whereas now whether or not attorney fees are awarded is within the discretion of the judge. It would also apply these changes retroactively. There's another provision under the existing law which provides that...
What changes are applied retroactively?
All of the changes proposed in the bill.
Have you researched, or has anyone researched the question? Are we simply dealing with a remedy so that we can apply it retroactively?
I think that clearly you cannot apply the provision that relates to the awarding of attorney fees retroactively. But as to whether or not you can apply the fluid recovery, leaving two pays for notice in the discretion of the court, it's my opinion that you can. That certainly is arguable. But I think that if you were to pass this bill applying those provisions retroactively, you certainly the legislature would, or the state would not have an unreasonable position in arguing that these are procedural matters, and therefore you can give them retroactive effect.
Has there been a case, you know, that we've had this in attorney's fees in Oregon? Sometimes the attorney's fee seems to be a substantive part of the contract. Other times we allow attorney's fees as a part of the cost. If this were changed, I'm not sure that it isn't that way, so that attorney's fees were allowed as a part of the cost, do you think that could be done retroactively?
Yes, yes, this is the one that these statements don't feel very close and unnecessary.
Thank you. I'm Craig Larry, an attorney from Los Angeles. I represent the attorney company, and I've been asked because of my involvement in 1973 in the 19 Oregon class action statute by Mr. Donica, Associate of the Oregon Industry, to speak on behalf of his members and AOI that are concerned about this bill and Oregon Nuclear Council. I'll be very brief. We do not believe that the present statute has been in effect long enough to determine whether it will do those things it was intended to do in 1973 when it was enacted. We feel that at the request of the Senate Judiciary Committee, we participated in compromise our position. We were hopeful that the legislation would work. We do not believe it had sufficient time to be tested, nor that sufficient input has been made to the committee, nor do we follow the rationale for making a number of these changes which were not controversial at the time. We therefore feel that on a general basis, to amend the law at this point as a general proposition would discourage business interests from needing to compromise to find problems. We don't see on the table problem to respond to the first law.
This looks very complicated with a number of changes, but what we have done trying to put this all together is work from Rule 23 of the federal rule. And the elimination of those items on page 3, really their redundancy when you look at the specific provisions of Rule 23. There isn't another statute, I believe, in the United States complicated because most of them work right from Rule 23. I'd like to respond to some of the comments that Mr. Gawenda made. The 30-day notice provision we feel is unique in the Oregon statute in the first place. And in fraud cases, it's a disaster. If you send a letter to someone and say, we're going to file a lawsuit against you for fraud and large class action, you just get in time to destroy documents or get out of the state with the booty. And I think that that's very important to eliminate. The filing of the claim form provision, we feel, should be eliminated as an unnecessary expense in those types of cases where the information is on a computer. You can just push the button and know that the liability and the amount is on a computer. Why should you have to send a claim form? It's a great benefit to the defendant because a lot of people won't even see the claim form. Again, I think that this is a situation that we're defeating the Fifth Circuit hard game under Rule 23, but of course that exactly that. It was an overcharge case, bank case, information on a computer, and of course that looks to be a use of suspense. Just push the button and turn the money back to people. The fluid recovery, I think too that this committee might very well consider an excuse provision. I don't think that the wrongdoer should be allowed to keep the person as wrong. Now, this would be unique. The Oregon statute would be the only one in the country, and it would be the most liberal one. But I think it's far better than letting the wrongdoer keep the person as wrong where you can't identify the members of the class.
You mean no other state has a fluid recovery?
I don't think so. They have it in California because of the Dar case decided by the Supreme Court. They have a fluid recovery, but it's not an exception.
What do you think is common? Class action? Has it been held to be allowable under the common law in any jurisdiction, or is it generally not allowed?
No, it's not a statute in every jurisdiction.
Any other questions?
I move that the litigation can be changed so that any unclaimed portion be excused to the state under the same circumstances as in a state where the errors cannot be found. Now, that what that provides, if I remember the statute, and I haven't looked at it for years, but I think it provides that whether you can't find an error, it's paid over to the county treasurer, and he holds it for 6 years or something like that, and if eventually no one eventually claims it, then it speaks to the state. This would provide a means whereby in the future someone can establish the right to it, they get it, but eventually go to the state rather than being given to the Boy Scouts or something like that.
Testimony about the California case where there was an overcharge by the yellow taxi in Los Angeles, and the way the court handled it there was simply to order a reduction in the rate for an upcoming period of a year or two on the assumption that would be a way of returning those monies to the people from whence the money could come. And that sounds like an equitable distribution under the language of the statute. And I would not want to keep in that case because it would never find its way back to the users. And it may be equitable distribution or
refuse any alternative what the court had.
Would you want to put that in a law? If I were to make an amendment, proposal that is shall either exceed in accordance with these provisions or some other fair and equitable measure determined by the court. Well, that would be my motion. I know without due process. Previously when this bill was before the committee, and depending upon the individual member's request, I can either go to highlight a provision as I did previously, or simply field questions as I can do, whichever the committee may desire.
Highlight it.
Okay. First of all, this bill was the product of a joint effort by the Oregon State Bar Committee Corporation Limited Partnership, as well as the Corporation Division, to compare provisions of the current Oregon Business Corporation Act with those comparable provisions in the Model Act, and attempted to bring the Oregon Act into compliance with the Model Act as closely as possible. Exceptions that I would wish to highlight. Section 1 of the bill, beginning at page 4, line 16, adds the term employee to the terms to defined in the statute, and it now defines employee to include officers of a corporation, but not necessarily directors, unless the director also happens to accept duties which would make an employee. Now, this amendment should not be read in isolation. It should be read in conjunction with the amendment proposed by Section 19, which appears on page 17 at line 31. Section 19, well, the current provision of the Oregon law prohibits loans to officers and directors and loans secured by shares of the corporation unless they're approved by two-thirds shareholders vote. Now, the proposed amendment would now allow such loans and make the business purpose or the corporate benefit to be a determinative criteria as to whether such a loan should be made. Clearly, the board of directors under the proposed amendment would continue to be responsible for any improper loans. The board of directors would also decide what security or collateral, if any, should be taken for such loans.
the amendment would do no violence to the traditional standards that the use of corporate funds for other than corporate purposes would continue to be improper. I think the committee should not have any fear that a sole stockholder in a closed corporation, this amendment could make a personal loan to himself without sustaining the burden of proof that it was for a corporate purpose. Section 3 of the bill, the other section I wish to highlight, that appears on page 6. This, along with various other sections, such as Section 24 and Section 25, do away with the various shareholder voting requirements prior to taking a certain corporate action. The philosophy of the Model Act has been to reduce the shareholder vote requirements for corporate action to a simple majority. The current Oregon statute has various voting requirements depending upon the action to be taken, such as liquidation upon dissolution, take a certain type of vote, sale of assets outside of regular course of business, take a certain type of vote, merger, consolidation, reclassification, requires another. The amendment that we would propose simply reduces it to a simple majority. The primary intention, I think, for following this approach is that many times requiring a two-thirds or three-quarters vote in some instances may be an impossibility to achieve, and therefore instances could arise where minority shareholders simply do not wish to appear at shareholders' meetings and can boycott certain actions and prohibit them from taking, which essentially would be ruled by the minority in some circumstances, as well as quorum requirements and proxy requirements. So we feel that a majority of votes would help. Section 10 of the bill, which appears on page 11 at line 10, deals with a complete rewrite of 57-136 dealing with preemptive rights to shareholders. Now, the current language of 57-136 indicates that preemptive rights to shareholders are defined by enumerating the instances in which they are specifically do not apply. Now, the amendment would make this provision identical with the Model Business Act. We would provide for automatic preemptive rights and except in specific instances for its elimination is believed to be in the best interest of the corporation. For example, no preemptive rights would exist to acquire any shares that were given to any officers, directors, employees, subjects, any plan that's been approved by the shareholders. Felt that those particular shares were designed for a specific purpose and could not be first made available to shareholders. Second of all, shares that have been acquired by individuals for consideration other than cash. In many instances, the corporation may wish to acquire a piece of property to the issuance of securities, and if those securities would first not be made available to the shareholders, it may very well prevent the acquisition of that piece of property for the exchange of stock. And the last three types of instances in which preemptive rights were prohibited deal with instances in which the type of security that is held by certain holders already has certain preferential rights as to liquidation, voting, or dividends, and they should not be given the additional rights to acquire certain shares under the preemptive rights. Section 22 is a provision that would be worthy of comment. It appears on page 20, line 18. The provision would essentially permit a new flexibility as to form of record keeping, as long as the new form of record keeping was convertible to a written form for inspection purposes.
and addition, the system sets the corporate books and records by shareholders to relevant books and records. Now, when I previously testified before the committee, Madam Chairman raised the point that who would determine what books and records are relevant. Well, as I answered at that time, I would assume that the determination would be made by the officers and directors or the holders of the books and records. But if it ever came to a dispute, that the burden of proof in a court of law would rest with the person making the claim to the books and records. But we would assume that though legal men may differ, that the denial of the right to inspect a certain book based upon its alleged irrelevancy would not be unreasonable. That would be a sense, well, and section 33, I did want to indicate as I testified before that we would request the committee to amend the bill to delete section 33, which appears on page 32, line 26, and I believe that the last time this bill was before the committee, that amendment was submitted. Without going into lengthy history, which I testified to before, if we left in section 33 as it currently is in the proposed bill, it would be in conflict with section 30 as it is amended, because section 33, as it is proposed to be amended now, was once the original language, and we have sought an amendment back in 1962 to make it read the way it is currently. So we didn't want to take a step back, which would be inconsistent. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah. Are there any provisions of this act that go beyond the Model Act?
No, Senator, no. In all instances, it either comply or something in modification as far as language that makes sense for all groups yet.
So we've got section 33.
I think it's just using section 33. Is there any question?
What is it there? He just explained it.
33 numbers.
It's going back into the old one.
Again, I'm guessing you remember the motion.
I have a question on my.
Any motion on the job?
Madam Chairman. Mr. Kowski, do you recall if we acted on your amendment that came along with your written statement back on March the 14th?
I believe the only amendment was the one deleting section 33, Senator, I believe.
Well, it was on page 2, there was a deletion of page 2 to Penny Bill, line 6, your written amendment wanted to knock out 57.716.
And that referred to section 33 because,
I don't think we acted on those things.
I'm sorry, we all know. That would be it.
Okay.
Excuse me,
we got line 32, line 26 to 32. Those are the lines we just knocked out. Is it wrong? Yeah. Okay. Both of them say that I'm making motions to
go. Anybody need to start as well? You found it
started. Well, I'm the bill. Before I'm the bill, then. Then we'll have
them. Aye.
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 I don't think you can get to the